This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Matthew Sittman, once a conservative Catholic, now is a liberal one, associate editor of the liberal Catholic journal, Commonweal. He also co-hosts a podcast, Know Your Enemy, tracking the intellectual drift of the extreme right, intently following the debates in the journals and elsewhere, which I suspect is why he named his podcast, with some irony, because as he's observed over and over again, that religious conservatism, with the validation of its leading intellectuals, has migrated to Trumpism, where what was once the opposition is now the enemy, which must be vanquished now and forever, that enemy being political liberalism.
Liberalism is not the partisan contemporary political meaning, but liberalism is a political philosophy grounded in individual rights, human equality, the rule of law, due process, constitutional governments are what they're rejecting, especially the individualism and the equality of it. When you take aim at human equality, that's also the basis, not just of, say, a liberal judicial order, but the foundation of democracy. One person, one vote. That is what they're rejecting. They're saying that actually they know better.
That's from our conversation back in December. We were talking about a manifesto published in First Things called Against the Dead Consensus. The dead consensus meaning the majority, most of us, who don't know better, which may be true, but couldn't the same be said of them?
When they reject something like liberal proceduralism.
You used air quotes then.
Right. What does that mean? If you're from the wrong group, you don't get your day in court, you don't have certain protections, you can be arrested or deported at the whims of a president. The ends justify the means. It's what you give yourself permission to abide by. It's what you're willing to overlook.
Can it justify the creation of an authoritarian state?
I would hope not. If you are a believing Christian who believes in a highest good, that should determine not just the ends, but the means. But I think in practical politics, that gets lost. When you look back to recent conservative history, even a magazine like First Things, under its former editor, Richard John Newhouse, who was a conservative Catholic priest, they ran a symposium in the 1990s about the judiciary and democratic political life. They were extremely concerned that the judiciary was imposing liberal values. What was interesting about it was not that conservatives disagreed with liberal judges. That's to be expected. But what they did was say, these liberal judges are thwarting democracy. The majority really does believe what we do. There is a moral majority. They use the language of democracy against liberal elites. Today, they are no longer speaking the language of a democratic majority, of the people being with them. They are saying, we must crush our enemies. Because we are right. We know what the highest good is. That move from democracy to simply saying we're right is the essential thing. You can see a situation arising in which Republicans keep trying to hold on to power despite not being a majority. And my concern is that these conservative intellectuals are creating the conditions or giving themselves permission to go along with what amounts to authoritarian rule by a political party that doesn't have anywhere close to the support of a majority of Americans.
In your podcast, you quoted from Damon Linker, who's a former editor at First Things as well, and now a moderate.
Yes.
He wrote, When social conservatives thought that they were the moral majority, it made sense for them to dream of exercising real political power. When they recognized that they were a minority, it made sense for them to resign themselves to adopting a defensive posture and preparing to live out their days in a country as dissenters from the reigning liberal consensus. What makes no sense is for social conservatives to think that they can be both weak and strong at the same time, a minority that wields the power of a majority. Unless, of course, social conservatives no longer care about democracy.
He put it very well, and that's an apt summary of my concerns that I'm expressing. That the key is to implement the highest good, to implement the order they think is true and just and good. And the ways you get there matter less.
Given what's transpired in the last 10 months, and given that Utah Senator Mike Lee is in lofty company in dissing democracy, we called Matt Sitman back to discuss the escalating project of applying their ideas by leveraging our least democratic institutions, the Senate, the Electoral College, and of course the Supreme Court. But first, I wanted his take on the most anti-democratic thing I'd read lately, published back in March in The Atlantic. It was written by Harvard Law professor Adrian Vermeule, calling on his ideological allies to rise from their defensive crouch and embrace what he calls common good constitutionalism that, quote, does not suffer from a horror of political domination and hierarchy because it sees that law is parental, a wise teacher, and an inculcator of good habits. Just authority in rulers can be exercised for the good of the subjects, if necessary, even against the subjects' own perceptions of what is best for them. Perceptions that may change over time anyway, as the law teaches, habituates, and reforms them. Subjects will come to thank the ruler whose legal strictures, possibly experienced at first as coercive, encourage subjects to form more authentic desires for the individual and common goods. Now, Vermeule is a bit of a provocateur, but I wanted Matt Sitman's take on his formulation that says, common good constitutionalism is not tethered to particular written instruments of civil law or the will of the legislators who created them. Its main aim is certainly not to maximize individual autonomy or to minimize the abuse of power, but instead to ensure that the ruler has the power needed to rule well.
I saw that as Vermeule saying that judges should not get in the way of rulers coercing their subjects to behave according to the dictates of morality that they perceive to be correct. And that certainly aren't views that the majority of Americans hold. So I think one thing it indicated to me was the lack of regard for the general views of the population. But I would say even more, the note about not deferring to the will of legislatures is really important. Because I think another aspect of this so-called common good constitutionalism is the deference that Vermeule wants courts to pay, judges to pay, to the executive branch and the administrative state. Vermeule is someone very influenced by the Nazi jurist Carl Schmitt, and the executive power plays a similar role in Schmitt's thinking.
He was really a Nazi?
Yes, served the Nazi regime.
Mike Lee said we're not a democracy, and democracy isn't the objective anyway. How, since we spoke in December, have the Trump administration and the Republican Party been trying to implement a set of intellectual ideas?
Most of all, there's just a hostility towards voting, the very bedrock of democracy. That's why they're undermining the Postal Service, why Trump has told his supporters to monitor polling places, which really, as we saw in Virginia in early voting, included kind of jeering at people going in to vote. Trump has told his supporters to vote twice. Trump himself said they had to install Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court could be counting the ballots. Now, that's not exactly how it works, but it's totally possible that litigation could come before the Supreme Court that does settle the outcome of the election. He said again and again that voting by mail is fraudulent. to prepare his supporters to not accept the outcome of the election, and even more, taint the outcome of the election, which would justify the litigation that aimed at overturning the outcome. And of course, this is a man that a majority of the country has never supported, installing someone on the most anti-democratic branch of the United States government.
You didn't mention Trump declining to commit himself on the peaceful transfer of power.
What Trump did when he told the Proud Boys to stand by, when he refused to condemn white supremacists, it was giving them permission to wreak havoc because he's casting doubt on the outcome of the election. It doesn't take a lot to connect the dots. That's a threat. I don't know what Trump consciously intends or not, but he said over and over that he doesn't really expect to win the election. Do you know anyone who thinks Donald Trump will win a majority of votes? It's the way it will happen will be through the Electoral College and possibly through the strategy of litigation, disruption, claims of fraudulence, and then a Supreme Court possibly deciding it. The kidnapping plot of the governor of Michigan, that's just proof that his rhetoric matters.
You said that within 20 to 30 years, it's possible that 70% of senators will be representing 30% of the country?
By 2040, it's predicted that 70% of the country will live in 15 states. That means that 70% will be represented by only 30 senators. That's a huge imbalance, and it is tricky because that number is actually not radically different than what has existed at other periods in our history. But what makes it so deeply troubling is that never before has our country been polarized the way it is. The difference between rural voters and urban and suburban voters is so great that the system's structural problems are running into the buzzsaw of polarization that it'll be balanced kind of radically against the Democratic Party.
There's an irony here that in order to be utterly traditional and support what we always believed was majority rule, we would have to do things like add states and increase the size of the Supreme Court.
Yes. And I think what you're seeing now, Brooke, is that the Republican Party knows that the situation is no longer tenable. It's been interesting. The New York Times columnist Jamelle Bouie has commented on this recently, that we've seen these big fights over the court at moments when a kind of rising majority is on the cusp of gaining power at the expense of the old order. And that happened in 1800 when Jefferson won the presidency and the Federalist Party was on the outs. They installed as many judges as possible to thwart Jefferson's incoming administration. It happened in the run-up to the Civil War. When you think of Dred Scott, I mean, that decision essentially outlawed the Republican Party's platform, declared it unconstitutional. And so what we're seeing now is this kind of inflection point where this minority party is trying to cling to power, even as it's very clear there's a rising majority that opposes it. And so this moment we're in, where Democrats could pack the court or disempower it in various ways, change its jurisdiction, could add states like Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, that would be something that, in the short term at least, would start to rebalance our system in a more democratic direction.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Brooke.
Matthew Sitman is associate editor at Commonweal Magazine and co-host of the Know Your Enemy podcast.
Coming up, size matters, at least when it comes to your generation.
This is On the Media.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.